Thank you, Wayne. Yeah, my history with this church goes back quite a ways. I met my future wife when I was at your college. She had been converted in this congregation. She was a high school student who was dating a young high school student from this congregation. His name was Roger Dunham. And she started coming to church with him and eventually studied with Monroe Hawley and was converted to Christ. Roger and Sue talked about marriage for a while, but Roger had some wandering eyes and decided to look for someone else. And so they broke up. Sue then talked to Monroe, said, what's she going to do when they got out of high school? He said, well, go to York College. So she went to York College, and there she met me. And she and I were married in 1968 here in this congregation, 53 years ago. And went on from that point on to finish my college at York, Oklahoma Christian College, and then began preaching the gospel. I preached in Andover, Kansas for 5 years, and then moved to Wausau in 1975, and I've been in Wisconsin since 1975, 46 years, I think it is, if I count right. Over the years, I've learned a great deal and grown quite a bit, and I've grown to meet many of you. I asked my wife if she wanted to come with me today. She said, nobody would be there that she knows, because everyone either moved away or died. So that's kind of the nature. After 53 years, a congregation changes hands. And so you have me today to be with you, but that's all you're going to get today as far as my family is concerned. I'm going to talk to you now today about the concept of the potter and the clay, and in the process do a little bit of confession about my own life, because I think God has worked in my life as he has worked in your lives as well. One of the things I often was amazed about the Apostle Paul as I read through his speeches in the book of Acts was that whenever he got up to talk about why he was arrested or why he was being looked at and so forth, he began to tell his own story, that he was a persecutor of Christians, and then Jesus interfered in his life, and then his whole life was changed. So Paul was shaped by the hand of God in sort of the way a potter would shape the clay. The story that was read to you, Jeremiah, is a very basic story where Jeremiah, and all of you understand this, you've all probably worked with clay, or at least you had your children work with clay. Clay is a wonderful substance. You can take it, you can squeeze it, and squish it, and push it, and mold it, and make it all kinds of wonderful shapes. He was talking about going to the potter's house where he watched the potter working with clay on a wheel. Their wheel was pretty basic. You had a basic round wheel attached with a pole to another wheel on the bottom, and the foot on the bottom would turn the wheel on the bottom, and the top wheel would turn so that he could then shape the thing into whatever he wanted to shape in, use some kind of a pot or some kind of a vase or something like that. And if it didn't work out right, well, then he would just do it again, do it differently until he shaped it the way he wanted to shape it and so forth. And the message then is given to Jeremiah saying, can't I do to Israel what this potter has done to the clay? It's a pretty obvious question. And yet, as you go further in that chapter, especially verse 12, he knows the people will say to him, when Jeremiah says to the people, this is what I want you to do. If you just listen to me and do what you want me to do, I want you to do, things will go well with you. But if you don't, then I have disaster I'll bring upon you. Their answer is going to be, it's no use. We've made up our mind, we're going to do what we want to do, and you can't change us. Makes me think about a humorous story that happened with my mother and my aunt. They were traveling one time, and my aunt is a little bit older than my mother, so she always was talking. You know how sisters talk, so she was the older one, so she kind of berated her. And they got on the wrong road, and my aunt turned to my mother and says, you didn't tell me that we got on the wrong road. What's the matter with you? My mother was looking at the map and said, oh, she's trying to explain how they got off the wrong passage. And, of course, the argument became more and more heated. And finally, my aunt said, and this is a quote I often will mention quite a bit. My aunt said, don't confuse me with the facts when my mind's made up. I don't know about you, but I've heard that before in all kinds of situations. I hear the facts, here's how we got it, but don't confuse me because I got my mind made up. You're a lousy person, you made a mess of it, and here we go. And I've known people like that, not just my own aunt, but all kinds of people who sometimes got their mind made up and they don't want to hear any different. It's different. My mind's set. They would say to God, it's no use. You can't change this because I've got my mind made up. This is what I'm going to do. And so the idea is that that's how the potter works with clay. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Romans in Romans chapter 12, that we don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. There's where the shape of the clay takes place, is the mind is constantly being renewed. We don't think the way we normally would think because God has shaped our thinking by giving us different reasons to think differently, to see things differently. When you become a Christian, your perspective is changed. You see the world differently than you did before. That's part of the shaping of God that takes place in your life. In my own life, here's a little bit of confession that comes along the line. I remember being in high school. I was a sophomore in high school. My father wanted to move away from California where we lived. He wanted to buy a farm because he grew up on a farm. He thought that's what he wanted. He wanted to get away from the gangs and the drugs and all kinds of stuff that was happening in California. So he bought a farm, but he didn't have enough money to pay for it right away. So he and my brother and I lived, my grandparents who lived on a farm in Missouri, while he still worked at getting everything picked up. So I was living on a farm in Ava, Missouri, on my grandfather's farm, and I was going to school. And it was a school dedicated to farming, basically. So I joined FFA. Don't know if you've heard of that, Future Farmers of America. I was going to be a farmer. I got a pig, and I was going to raise this pig as my project. And my plan was that I was going to be a farmer. And somewhere along the line, and not long after that, I was baptized, became a Christian. And so I'm going to church regularly and learning how to try to be a farmer on the way. And one day, someone taps me on the shoulder. It's a young preacher. He says, Roy, I want you to do me a favor. I'm, 16 years old? I'm as naive as they come. Sure, I'll do you a favor. What you want? I want you to speak for me when I'm gone. And I'm too dumb to say, I can't do that. So I say, okay. All right, he says, okay, what are you going to speak about? I don't know. Speak about baptism. Okay. What are you going to say? I don't know. He has to literally write out the sermon for me, all right? So he's got it all worked out. He takes me to church every Saturday, and I practice preaching to an empty pulpit, just him sitting, until he tells me, no, don't say it this way. Say it that way. Speak louder, look up, don't all the various things you try to do as you learn how to speak. And at the end of it, then he's gone. I preached that day, and everyone says, what a great job you did, Roy. And I think to myself, wow, maybe I could do this. And I changed the direction of my life in that time. I was going to be a farmer, and suddenly I'm going to become a preacher. Something changed me. God shaped me in a different way by using someone to tap me on the shoulder. Sometimes I associate it with the prophet Amos. You know, Amos describes himself as being a young man working in the sycamore trees. And suddenly God took him. He's not the son of a prophet. He's not the father of a prophet. He doesn't come from a family of prophets. But God makes him a prophet. Here I am. I'm not the son of a preacher. I'm not even a grandson of a preacher. I have nothing to do with being preaching at all. But suddenly I'm going to become a preacher. So everything I try to do in my life is geared toward preaching. And I'm one of the few people in my class in high school actually did what I intended to become. Most of them, were going to be this and that and the other. And you know how it is in high school or even in college. You choose a major and you study toward that thing. And then you get out, you're not doing whatever you studied for. Most of the kids I studied in college changed their majors two or three times before they got out of college. And then when they get out, they end up getting a job doing completely nothing at all to what they studied to. And that's life. And for me, it was different because I studied to be a preacher and I actually became a preacher. So I was really glad to be able being a preacher. And so I was doing that. And I went along for about 20 years. I moved to Wausau. I was up in Wausau. I came down to Madison. And I was in Madison here. Suddenly I get a phone call from a preacher in Northtown Church. He calls me and says, I just got a call. There's someone needs to be baptized. Would you go baptize him? Okay. What's his name? He's in prison. I've never been to prison before. Okay. What's his name? His name is Jeffrey Dahmer. You may recognize the name here in Milwaukee because it's kind of an important name here. Later on, I would write a book on the subject, and people would ask me about the impact Jeffrey Dahmer had on the city of Milwaukee. And I'd often say, it's kind of like what happened to Dallas when JFK was assassinated there. There was an impact to the city with the Jeffrey Dahmer story that's similar to the impact to the city of Dallas when JFK was killed. There was a psychological impact that occurred in Milwaukee. The people felt scandalized by the fact that this happened under their noses. It happened right here. 16 young men were killed by that man. And it's unfortunate because when they were killed, most of the people didn't know, or they were missing, weren't even looking for the people, didn't even understand what was going on. Oh, some of the local families might have, but there wasn't any posters up on the telephone pole saying you're wanted or looking for this. You didn't have milk cartons with people's pictures. Nothing like that. They weren't looking for the monster of Milwaukee because they didn't know he'd existed. That was quite a shame, quite a shock. So suddenly I'm thrown into going to visit someone in prison. And after the Jeffrey Dahmer story occurs, and you have heard probably similar about it, he's eventually murdered after a while. And a year ago, and I don't visit anybody in prison for that at all. Then someone comes and interviews me on television because it's been a year. Talk about the Jeffrey Dahmer story. So I tell a bit about that. And then an inmate watches that on TV. And so he writes me and says, hey, you visited Jeff, come visit me. And then another one says, hey, you visited him, you can visit me too. And next thing you know, I get prisoner after prisoner. And suddenly I've got a prison ministry going on that I didn't know anything about. No one taught me how to do prison ministry. You just go and do it. So my life gets molded and shaped again in a different sort of way. And I felt bound to do these things because I felt that God had something to do with the whole thing. A door was opened by God. I didn't open the door. God opened the door. And do I walk in the door or not? I felt like I had to because God opened the door for me. So God was molding and shaping my life in ways I didn't intend for it to be. I had in my own mind a certain idea about what I wanted to be when I grew up, and completely it turned out differently. And even when I began to go down that life, things changes again differently in a different sort of way. And so, yes, I'm the guy that baptized Jeffrey Dahmer, and I'm the guy that would eventually visit many other prisoners over the course of several years. So, yeah, I've had that experience, and that's part of my history, part of my story as I go through my life. But the idea is that you have to be pliable in the hands of God. Sometimes we don't want to be pliable. We want to let God, we want to tell God, you can't tell me what to do. We're like the character that Paul describes in Romans chapter 9 when he says, shall the clay say to the potter, why have you made me this way? What right have you got to form me the way you have? Don't we live in an age when people are asking that question today? Young men are asking, why am I a young man when I want to be a young girl? Or young girls say, why am I a young girl when I want to be a young boy? God messed up by making me. I'm sorry, you don't know who you're talking to. You know who you're talking about. Can the clay say to the potter, why'd you make me this way? I don't approve of the way you made me. You don't have any right to say that to God. You don't understand who God is. A lot of it really comes down to the fact they don't believe in God. Or what they believe about God is less than what God actually is. They believe maybe that God is real, but they don't believe God is wise. They don't believe God knows what he's doing. They don't believe God understands what's happening. I'm deeply moved by the story of Job. Job is a very powerful. It's profound to me because it's believed that Job is probably one of the first books of the Bible ever written. They believe that because nothing in the book of Job mentions anything about the characters that God associates with the rest of the history of the Bible. No mention of Abraham, no mention of any of the patriarchs, Noah, or none of the characters like that are mentioned in the book of Job. It just suddenly, there was a man in the city of, in the land of Ur, whose name was Job. And we just jump right into this story right there. And we don't know much about him. And yet he seems to have some kind of a relationship with God that's powerful. And God himself says of Job, he's a righteous man. He's the most righteous man we've got. So you had the story of God meeting with all the various sons of God or angels, and the Satan is there, Ha-Satan. In Hebrew, it's actually Ha-Satan. It's not his name, it's his title. We don't know his name. We often refer to him as Satan because that's his title. It means the adversary or the accuser. And what have you been doing? I've been going to and fro across the earth. What's he been doing? He's been looking for people to condemn before God. And God then brings up Job. What do you think about my servant Job? What about him? You haven't said anything about him? Well, excuses are given. You protect him. You got him surrounded. Anyone who would serve you if you've got that kind of blessing. Oh, yeah? And so you got this thing between God and Satan going back and forth. And it was amazing to me to realize that the problem Job had was not because Job didn't believe in God. The problem Job had is because God believed in Job. Satan says, oh, he won't serve you. God says, oh, yeah? My man wouldn't give up on me at all. My man believes me. He's going to serve me all the way. Oh, yeah, let's test that. And so you got the first round of stuff that happens. And you have the second round that comes later on after he's not only lost his 10 children and all of his animals and so forth, oh, you haven't touched a skin, Job says, touch a skin. And so terrible diseases occur to him, and we have a hard time even understanding the diseases. And so Job goes through this long period of suffering, horrible suffering. And some of the suffering is his three friends come to help him, and they don't help him much other than to say, boy, you really messed up, Job. I didn't mess up. Yeah, you really messed up. And you get chapter after chapter of this back and forth. And finally, Job begins to break down by questioning not whether God exists, but whether God is his friend any longer, where God no longer loves him, or God has turned against him. There's where Job's problem is. So he cries out, come on, show your face, God. Show your face to me. Tell me what's going on. Tell me why. Whenever something happens to us, we always want to cry out, why? And God finally shows up, and we think, oh, good, now God's going to tell him why. So we figure God's going to say, okay, Job, a funny thing happened the other day. Me and Satan were talking about you, of all things, and here's what he said, here's what I said, and here's why this all came out. And we think Job said, oh, now I get it. That doesn't happen that way at all. That's not how the book ends. Instead, God gets on this thing about, so you think you're so smart, Job. Where were you when I made the world? And he gets into this long detail about how you make the world. And all Job says, duh. And then God shifts into making and running the world. What about taking care of this creature that? You're talking about behemoth and leviathan and the asses and the ostriches and the owls. All kinds of creatures, all kinds. And you've got to take care of all these creatures, all that are doing it. Basically saying to Job, Job, I'm running the world and I know what I'm doing, Job. And you've got to trust me. And to me, that's one of the most profound lessons of all time. The first book of the Bible, and God's dealing with the problem of suffering. Why do atheists believe there is no God? Basically, it comes down to the fact that there's so much suffering in the world. How can there be so much evil and God doesn't do a thing about it? So the atheists say, well, if God is there, he doesn't either care about evil or he's not powerful to take care of evil because evil's still there. So they've got a problem with evil. The evil shouldn't be here. So they don't believe in God because of that. And here's the first book of the Bible where God's saying, yeah, sometimes life gets to be kind of tough. Sometimes life can be really bad. But I'm still there for you. God was shaping and molding Job even though Job was already pretty much perfected. He was a righteous man when he started out. He's a righteous man when he gets done. Job will maintain his righteousness all the way through. But Job had to learn the most powerful lesson of all time. Trust him. God knows what he's doing. You see, God doesn't answer why questions. Someone gave me a CD a few years ago of the ACU Alumnus Chorus singing songs basically in the songbook we have now because a lot of them are new songs. And so I listened to it, and I only got volume 4 because he had duplicates, and so he had too much. Here, you can have mine for free. Oh, thanks a lot. So I get to listen to some. I listened to it on the way here, in fact. There's one song that really struck me in there. It's song number 600 in your songbook, that God leads his children along. I've got the words here somewhere. Just a minute here. Let me get the wording just right. Well, no, I can't find it. That's the way it is, isn't it? All right. Yeah, God leads us along. There it is here. Here, God leads us along. Yeah. In shady green pastures, through rich, so rich and so sweet, God leads his children along. Where the waters cool, flow, bathes weary feet. God leads. But where it gets me is the core or the refrain, because it's some kind of. Some through the waters, some through the flood, some through the fire, but all through the blood. Some through great sorrow, but God gives a song in the night season all the day long. And that really profoundly affected me. Because sometimes life is like that. You know, when Jesus told the story about the two men that build their houses, one build on a rock, one build on the sand, he's talking about how life is like that. We build houses. You know, we build our things. But both men, regardless of what they build upon, have the same weather. The rains come, the winds blow, and the waves beat against both houses. And one stands and one falls. And I think Jesus is saying, you know, life is like that. Doesn't matter what you build your house upon, the rain's going to come anyway. So build your house on a firm foundation, because your house is going to have to withstand the troubles of what life is. Life is kind of like that. In the song, God leads his children sometimes through difficult paths, some through the waters, some through the flood, some through the fire, but all through the blood. The blood, of course, referring to the blood of Jesus Christ. Wow. In the Bible, the prophecy is made of Hezekiah that God would bring waters, flood of waters, up to his neck. It didn't happen literally, but it happened figuratively. You ever hear of Sennacherib? That's a character that was brought against Hezekiah. He was a leader, he was a commander of the Assyrian army, and they came and they were conquering all kinds of places, and they come to Jerusalem, and they surround Jerusalem, and they cry out to the people on the wall, "Don't believe Hezekiah. Don't trust his God. All these other people we conquered, they trusted their God, and look what we did to them, and we'll do the same thing to you too." And Hezekiah says, talk to the people in Hebrew. We can understand your Arabic. No, we're going to talk to people in Hebrew because we want them to hear. Don't trust your God. Hezekiah turns to the Lord, and lays out the actual letter that says, and look what they wrote. Look what they said about you. And God said, I'll take care of it. And the King James has a funny way of putting it. And the next morning, they woke up dead. How do you wake up dead? Well, someone woke up, and 180,000 were dead. He was led through the flood. Up to his neck, almost. In the book of Daniel, had the three men who were actually led to the fire. Bow down to this idol, or we will throw you in the fire. Nope, we're not going to do it. We'll make it seven times hotter. We're still going to throw you in the fire. You don't bow down. And their answer is so powerfully faithful. Our God could rescue us if he wanted to, but even if he doesn't, we're not bowing down. We're going to follow our God even if it leads us into the fire. We'll throw you into the fire, so I throw him in the fire, and the men who throw him into the fire themselves are caught by the fire itself and burn up. And they walk through the fire, and they come out, there's not even hair singed, not even smell of smoke. God protecting them. God led them to the fire. And the great psalm in the Old Testament, "The Lord is my shepherd." You've heard the song, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." You know that one we all must always memorize. There's a section where it says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil." Well, how did you get into the valley of the shadow of death? Well, the shepherd led me there. Why would he lead you there? Because sometimes that's where we've got to go. As I've gotten older, I've begun to realize and appreciate what Paul meant when he says, and Paul's writing in prison, when he says this, "Rejoice." And again, I say rejoice. You've heard that passage in Philippians. But Paul's in prison when he writes this. I've visited prison, people in prison. Most of them aren't thinking about joy. It's kind of hard to think about joy when you're in prison all the time. And yet Paul says, "Rejoice in the Lord." And I say again, rejoice. And you begin to think about the Christian path of joy. What is that really all about? And most of us think of joy as, ha, 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 joy, life happy, joyful, and gay, have a good, wonderful time. Isn't it wonderful? Great to be a Christian. You know, the sun is shining, and the sky is blue, and the flowers are blooming, and the birds are tweeting. Isn't life wonderful? Yeah, sometimes joy is like that. But sometimes for the Christian, joy is not just that. Sometimes there's great sorrow. That song mentions some through great sorrow. He leads us through the valley of the shadow of death. I've known people who've lost loved ones. I've lost loved ones. I remember saying goodbye to my father as he's dying, and I knew it was the last time I'd ever see him again. And I'm talking about how, we'll see you later on, Dad, but you got to go be with God now. I remember crying for 100 miles as I'm driving home till I finally ran out of liquid. I understand a certain amount of sorrow. I've known people who've lost children, and it would take them decades to get over that loss. Great sorrow. We've all had great sorrow. We've all had great losses. And that's what life is all about. And sometimes God leads us through great sorrow. Why is God doing this? He doesn't answer why. I know what I'm doing. I'm running the world. I'm in charge of the world. You must trust me. If only we can learn to be pliable like the clay in the hands of the potter. Now, if we're not doing that, eventually God has another answer. Chapter 19 of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is told, go back to the potter's house. So he goes to the potter's house and he buys a pot that the potter has made. You know, potters make stuff. So he buys a pot. And he shows the people the pot. And he's holding the pot up and he talks about how they have become so hardened in their sins that they won't listen to God. And all that he can do is, and he takes the pot and he smashes it to the ground. And the pot is broken apart. And his point is, as Jeremiah broke the pot, so God will break you if you won't listen to him. In the book of Philippians, the Apostle Paul talks about his life, how he used to persecute Christians and so forth, and then Jesus interfered in his life. And Paul would say of his life, everything that was profit to me, I count but loss for the sake of knowing Jesus. When I was in high school, I moved to Wichita, Kansas after the farm thing. And in my high school, there was a young boy there who was really good at running. He had broken the world's record for the mile twice in high school. His name was Jim Ryan. We had all kinds of beliefs about him winning gold in the Olympics and so forth. And I remember going to his house one time. He was a member of the church and so forth. I'm going to his house, and in the basement, there was a whole wall of trophies that he had won throughout his life. I remember being really humbled. Wow, look at all these trophies. Wow, that's amazing. I never won anything, and here he's won all these trophies. And I think about the Apostle Paul like that. He was a young man who had all kinds of trophies. He had studied under the best of the rabbis of his day and time. He described himself as a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He was a notch above all the other kids. He had all the citations. He had all the blue ribbons. He had all the awards. He was the best little young Jew growing up that you could imagine. And he was going to persecute Christians because that's how he served God. And Jesus enters his life saying, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And his life was changed. And everything that was profit to him is lost. His life was broken by God as God reshaped him into what God would make him into later on, the kind of apostle he would be. So when God is molding you and shaping you, don't cry out to God, why are you doing this to me? Someone one time put actual words into the mouth of the clay that we sometimes laugh about. Imagine what the clay must think as the potter is shaping it. Why are you putting me on this wheel and spinning around and getting me all dizzy? What are you doing? Why are you pushing me and shoving me? Oh, you're poking me. Oh, it hurts. Don't do that to me. Oh, and it takes me off. Oh, finally, you stop this. And he put, now he's painting me. I can't believe. He's painting me. I can't do it. And then he puts me in this oven. Oh, it's all hot. I can't stand it. And finally, oh, what a beautiful thing he's made of me into. How we cry all the way as God makes us to what God's going to do with us. And God's like that. Sometimes we cry all the time. But we're still in the hands of God. God is molding us and shaping us and changing us into the kind of people he would have us to be. Sometimes he leads us on paths that frighten us. He leads us on paths that seem like it threatens us. Leads us through the water. Leads us through the flood. Leads us through the fire. Leads us through suffering. Sorrow. But God gives us song. God gives us song that gets us through the night, gets us through the day long, because God is the potter. We are the clay. As you think of your own story, we all have stories. I've told you a little bit of my story. You've got stories too. God is a powerful way of impacting us and changing us. Think about, how did you become the Christian you are today? What how has your life changed by God somehow working in your life? Because God has molded you just like he's molded me. God has something powerful to you. Sometimes terrible things happen to us that we feel so bad, so terrible. Now, I wrote a book about the Jeffrey Dahmer story, and I had to go around the country to promote the book and so forth. And people asked me, why did you write this book? And I didn't realize until after one of the elders I had read the book and had given to me, he said, you know, this is more not just a story about, it's not just the Jeff story. It's not just your story. It's God's story. I like the way you put that. The story is really all about how God has worked in his life. And people sometimes ask you, why did you, because some people I talk to cross denominational lines, and you have some, especially Baptists, that don't, they believe in baptism, they don't believe in baptism the way we believe in baptism, okay? So they don't think you need to be baptized at all. So why did Jeff need to be baptized? And I would say, rather than argue about those differences, can't you just rejoice that a sinner came to a Savior? That's really the story it's really all about. No, they can't do it because they've got to focus on the baptism. And so why did you write the book? And it occurred to me finally to give an answer. At one point in my life, this is when I was in Warsaw, I was criticized so severely that I began to question myself. Maybe you shouldn't have been a preacher. Maybe you made a mistake becoming a preacher. Maybe you spent all your life and all your time studying and working so hard to become a preacher, and maybe you just wasted your time. You shouldn't be a preacher at all. You're not worth anything like that. And I really began to believe what I call bad, I believe the commentary people were saying about me. And I began to embrace the commentary and began to believe it myself. And next thing you know, I was in such a deep pit of self-sorrow and sadness. All I could think about was dying. And I prayed, God, let me die. And I thought about suicide. Don't mention it, Roy. I thought about suicide. Eventually, I was able to be pulled out of it. My wife helped pull me out of it. Years later, when I met Jeffrey Dahmer, one of the questions he put to me was, now that he'd become a Christian, we studied together after he'd become a Christian, he says, I got a question. He says, I really feel bad about the things I committed, the terrible crimes I committed. Well, I said, you should feel bad. They're really bad things. I think I should have been put to death by the state, he says. I said, I agree, you should have been put to death by the state. Unfortunately, you don't live in a state that believes in that, so you weren't put to death by it. He says, well, now that I'm a Christian, am I sinning by living? Well, that opens the door to all kinds of thoughts, suicide included. As a matter of fact, been there, done that. I could talk to him about it because I'd been there. My wife would come, would mention to me later on, she, you know the things that happened to you that you feel so sorry, you feel sad about? They were preparing you to meet Jeff. At the time, I couldn't see it, didn't know it. God has such wonderful plans in mind. He does things to us sometimes that we think are hard and cruel and mean and uncaring. And God knows what he's doing. And God is preparing you for something else that comes down the line. Now that's a little bit of my story, but you have a story too. How somehow God touches your life as well. But I believe with all my heart there is a God. He is alive. That's the song we sing. He is real. He's very much a part of my life. He's a part of your life. And that's why we're here. And that's why we serve God. And that's why we believe in God, because God is the potter and we are the clay. And we want to submit to his hands because he knows what he's doing for all of us. And it doesn't matter how deep a pit you're in, as I've been there, he can reach down to the pit as far as you are and pull you out if you just hold on to his hand. That's our God. That's your God. That's what we're all about. I know the song, I think, The Great Redeemer, something like that. You know, I think that's the song we're going to sing afterward. I used to try to connect the end of the sermon to the song. Sometimes I don't do a very good job with that. But we have a great Redeemer who cares for us and has reached out for us and loves us. Redemption is such a marvelous thing, such a powerful thing. I'm tempted to steal something I want to talk about next Sunday, but that's all right. I'll do it anyway. In the book of Hosea, Hosea is told by God, go marry a prostitute. Are you crazy, God? I've done premarital counseling, you know. You know, some things you try to learn before you get married. You know, you don't go this way. Don't do that. Don't marry a prostitute. That's one of the worst ideas in the world. Are you crazy? No, Hosea does that. They have three children. One child they name after a battle that's about to take place. They name a little girl, Lo Ruhama, not loved. Can you imagine naming a little girl not loved? Oh, how cruel. And a little boy, name is Lo Ami, not my people. Well, it's the point God's going to make about all this. It comes out later on, because later on those names will be changed from Lo Ruhama to Ruhama and from Lo Ami to Ami. He's going to make those who are not loved and those not to his people. But eventually, she leaves him. She goes off to do her thing again. And he's alone with his children. And there's great sorrow. And then finally comes back. God says, Hosea, go to the slave market and buy a slave. And he goes there. And who's on the slave market but his ex-wife, Gomer? He's going to buy her. She's been used up by everybody. And they're tired of her. They don't need her no more. She's being sold for pennies on the dollar. She's not worth anything. Have you ever felt that way? You ever felt like you're not worth anything at all? And Hosea redeems her. He buys her back. Not to become his prostitute. He buys her back to become his wife again and the mother of his children. God will do that for you too. No matter how bad you feel about yourself, and you may feel as bad about yourself as Jeff felt about himself. You may feel like you're in such a deep hole that no one can get me out of this thing here. But God can reach. God will redeem you. He's the great redeemer. That's the one we turn to. If you're not a Christian, we encourage you to think about coming to God and allowing him to mold you and shape you into the kind of thing that God can turn you into something that's wonderful and beautiful in his sight. If you just be pliable, if you just submit, if you just give in to God, what a wonderful, wonderful creator our God is. And if you aren't a Christian, I encourage you to think about doing that while we, what do we stand and sing our song? Is that how we do this thing? Okay, I'm done. I'm going to stop talking now.